Welcome. You're listening to the Mac Observer's Background Mode. This is your host, John Martellaro. And this week, my guest is former Apple senior manager and entrepreneur, Dan Burkaw. Dan, good afternoon. Thanks for being on the show.
Thanks for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
Yeah, you sound great. And we've got an exciting show lined up. And so let's get into it. So we know you from your Apple days. I remember that you started off with TerraSoft Solutions. But as with people who sort of get into the Macintosh world, tell me about even before you started working for TerraSoft. What was happening with you was when you were growing up, and what got you excited about computers?
Well, it was just, I could learn, it just caught my curiosity, and I just wanted to consume everything about it. I remember we got our first computer at home. I had been exposed in elementary school to the Mac, the kind of the original Mac, the Apple IIe, and but we our first PC at home was at, our first computer at home was a PC. It was a 386 Intel.
And those were the days.
Absolutely. And I just remember, you know, so Windows 3.1 had just barely kind of come onto the scene, and I just learned everything I could about it. And pretty quickly, it wasn't a Mac. I was learning the Mac at school. And when I was at home, I felt like I had kind of started to hit the edge of what was possible on Windows. And so, you know, there's only, I sometimes tell people, there's only so many times you can change the background wallpaper and, you know, kind of make it your own until you feel like, well, what else is there here? And so I started to, somehow I found out, I don't remember exactly how or why, but I found, I learned about the Linux. The Linux project had started, and I remember thinking, man, I want to try this thing and I want to learn. And part of it was that our school district had a Unix system that the students were able to get access to for sort of early Gopher and you know, simple email within the district. And I remember having access to this, and part of what it was is it gave us the ability to go to a command line. So that kind of concept of being able to have the command line at home that I could learn things about was kind of appealing. So I remember spending an awful lot of time getting Slackware Linux onto, gosh, it seems like it must have been 30 floppies.
Oh my.
Just to be able to, you know, get it onto the machine.
Is and we didn't have you sit there with 30 floppies and go ka-chunk, ka-chunk. Oh my.
Yeah, and the installer would tell you it's time for the next one to get popped in, and it would take forever. And of course, one of the hardest parts of installing Linux at that time was that you had to partition your hard drive, so you had to create a separate section just for Linux. And we didn't have a very big hard drive; I think it might have been 500 megabytes. And I remember I kind of did this. My parents were none the wiser, and if they had known how kind of dangerous and destructive partitioning can actually be if you don't really know what you're doing,
it's especially scary in Linux because of these oddly named partitions you have to create.
Yeah, and this was the early days. There was no graphical installers. There was no, and really it was, you were interfacing at the barest level of the system. So anyway, I managed to get it installed, and I just, all I wanted to do was learn about this thing. And so I just built my own knowledge and taught myself different shell scripting languages like Bash. And then I started compiling my own kernels and just,
wow, you're still in high school at this point, right?
Oh yeah. Oh wow. Yeah.
So wow, this was pretty amazing. So how did you meet Kai then? We're talking about Kai Stotz, who you co-founded Terra Firma with in Fort Collins.
Well, TerraSoft, yeah. So he had started a web design firm before I met him called Terra Firma, and it was focused on having clients that were having, in many ways, some of their first web presences. And so I think New Belgium Brewing Company in Fort Collins was one of their first customers. And at some point I met him, and I think it was because I had an account on an internet provider that was across the hall from his office. And so sometimes I'd go over there and help that internet provider, because as I built my knowledge of Linux, I realized that I could actually get paid to help other people do things with Linux. So I was helping out this internet provider.
So you were already a gray beard.
Yeah, exactly. And I had I think I met him that way, and you know, he was starting to really have quite a number of customers, and realized that rather than having somebody else host those web pages that he was designing, it'd be great if he could bring that in house and you know, charge the customers to host it and kind of have it all controlled in one place. And so he approached me and wanted me to be his system administrator to run these websites, and I of course was excited to do that. But the only thing was that he was a big time Apple guy, and you know, as I got more towards the Linux side of my learning in computing, Apple wasn't as exciting anymore, from what I was learning with Linux. So he really wanted to host these things on a Mac. And I just thought that was not a very good idea, because at the time, you know, there was no Mac OS X. This is well before that.
There were some primitive web servers in Mac OS 9, weren't there?
Yeah, there were. There were some packages that were trying to do it. But at the time, Mac OS was, you know, kind of had a reputation for not really being able to compete with things like Windows Linux.
And so, once you're a Linux nutcase, you understand completely the value of it as a server system.
Exactly. So I really thought, man, we should host these things on Linux. And so he was like very adamant that it should be on a Mac, on an Apple equipment, and there had to be a way to do it that way, that where it was going to be reliable and fast access for the pages and so on. And so finally he kind of challenged me, and he said, well, is there a way to run Linux on the Mac? And that was kind of a strange question. I didn't know the answer. And so I went and did a little research, and lo and behold, there was this project called MK Linux that was kind of a research project. And Apple, I think, was one of the key sponsors, if not the sponsor of the project. And what it was is it was a port of the Linux kernel to run on top of a mock kernel, and then that could be deployed on a new bus based Mac. And later, I think they supported some PowerPC Macs as well. So we started exploring and investigating that. Our first server hosted some of the customer web pages on MK Linux running on a Mac in a closet in that office in Fort Collins, connected to a T1. Courtesy of the internet provider next door. But pretty quickly we kind of hit the limits of MK Linux. It wasn't always up to date with the Linux at that time was just starting to, you know, not explode yet, but really getting there, where there was lots of development. It was moving really, really quickly. And so pretty quickly we learned that if we wanted to keep doing this, we were going to have to find an alternative. And the alternative was already in development by folks in the development community. There was a Linux for PowerPC project. And so it was native Linux running on the Mac without the mock kernel. And it was kind of a much faster moving project. But the issue was that it was really fragile, because it was bleeding edge stuff. So we kind of identified an opportunity that maybe it'd be nice if there was something a little more commercial grade.
And you came along at just the right time, because, and we'll get to that in a second, but go ahead.
Yeah, so it kind of was the Apple connection. We were, Kai had pitched at one point to do some web work for Apple, and so he had some connections there, and got to talking to people about what we were doing with this MK Linux and hosting these web pages. And this was at a time where, as I said, NT was really, you know, getting some good publicity, I suppose is the way to put it.
It was beating up on Mac OS. It really was.
Yeah.
I remember at Lockheed Martin, there were 3,000 Macs that were dumped onto carts and hauled away as the company switched over to Windows NT. Preemptive multitasking, protective memory, logs, authentication, sign-in, everything you wanted in the enterprise. Oh.
Yeah, and Mac OS X, I mean, was not Mac OS X yet. There was Rhapsody,
right. And
the very initial effort was there, but it was going to be years away before OS X really hit the scene in a big way. And so we were being encouraged, if you will, or Kai was through some of these relationships, was kind of being encouraged to take a look at whether maybe we should be the folks to try to take the community project do our own work and then kind of commercialize an offering that had documentation and a community and a support system and really try to have something that could be sold into organizations like the one you mentioned.
Yeah, and that's just about the time I came on with Apple, and we were very excited about selling Apple hardware with Yellow Dog Linux on it to our government and military and commercial customers. Because of exactly what you said, there was that middle ground there where OS X was not mature enough yet, but we wanted to sell awesome Mac hardware, so we were really excited about you guys.
Yeah, and we went for it, and I remember being in this room with Kai, and we're trying to figure out what to name the thing, and you know, we end up on Yellow Dog Linux, and we were in part because we were trying to model ourselves somewhat after Red Hat, who had commercialized Linux on the on the PC side. Mm-hmm. And you know, there was a lot of interest. There was I remember the first day we got orders, and you know, we were kind of unconventional, and this was the Kai part. Kai was the unconventional one. He didn't want to do boxed software, so the first version of Yellow Dog actually came in this kind of binder, soft binder, and there was the manual and the CDs, and so we started to sell them. And mostly it was people that wanted to tinker, but at a certain point, what you were talking about some of these organizations, we started seeing research institutions, we started seeing government labs, we started seeing .gov agencies that were buying a copy here, a copy there, and we didn't know what they were doing with it, but at start because they were just buying it or downloading it from us, and we wouldn't hear from them. But that all started to change a little bit later.
Yeah, when Apple got its wagon moving with BSD Unix, finally. But in the meantime, it must have been heady time for you having all these customers wanting to run this fabulous Linux on Apple hardware. It looked like the sky was the limit at the time. You had some very famous customers, as I recall.
Yeah, and we were a small operation, to be clear. We were not a big operation because it really still was a niche of a niche, but the niche that we had was folks like Lockheed Martin who wanted to buy X-serves from Apple and put Yellow Dog on those X-serves and then put them on Navy submarines for sonar image processing or image acquisition. I remember once Kai and I went to a meeting at NASA JPL, and we were in the room where a lot of the imagery was coming off of the rovers on Mars. And they were, the big thing that was happening with some of these companies at this time was high performance computing, where you can link together multiple machines to get increased compute power.
Parallel processing.
Exactly. That was really starting to take off in the science, you know, in the science fields, and the processors and Moore's law was really driving them to always constantly be looking for what's the next best hardware we can tackle this problem with. And oh, by the way, Linux started to become kind of the standard, or Unix, if you will, started to become the standard way that they would keep their software portable, so they could always make these leaps to new hardware, but the software foundation was fundamentally similar or the same. At JPL, we're in this room, and they're, you know, trying to run some special image processing software on these little boxes running Yellow Dog. And it was just, yeah, it was super heady.
Seeing your product and used by NASA must have been an amazing feeling.
Yeah, and I'm a high school senior going into college. I mean, I don't remember the exact whether I was in college yet, but I mean, I was young, super young guy in some of these rooms, and kind of blown away by how people were using our stuff. I think even I was trying to recall there was other customers. I think Boeing at one point was using PowerMac G5s with those big 22-inch cinema displays that were so sexy at the time.
Those were awesome.
They had two of the displays and the PowerMac G5.
People lusted for those early cinema displays.
Oh yeah. And they I think they were using that rig with Yellow Dog to run some simulation software for one of the planes that they were developing for the military.
Awesome. So at this point, you're a senior, you're thinking about where you want to go to college. But right now, we need to think about taking a short break. Folks, we'll be right back after this short message. We'll be back in 60 seconds. Stay with us, and we'll return talking with Dan Brokaw.
Hello there, all you fabulous Background Mode listeners. I'm Kelly Gamont with the Mac Observer, and I just want to say a few words about how you can support all the things we do. If you're thinking about buying something from Apple, Amazon, or Mac Mall, just go to the Mac Observer's homepage, where we have a section called Support TMO. Or you can just enter macobserver.com/Apple Store, all one word, and that will take you to our special page for Apple and our other affiliates. If you make a purchase from one of our partners this way, the Mac Observer receives a small compensation for sending business their direction. Pretty cool, right? And you don't pay a penny more. This small fee from our affiliates helps us continue to bring you TMO's daily news, reviews, tips, how-tos, and podcasts like this one. So the next time you're thinking about an online purchase, come to TMO's homepage and support the Mac Observer. Thanks. Back to you, John.
We're back. Thanks, Kelly. We're talking to Dan Brokaw. So now you're thinking about college. Tell me what comes next.
Yeah, so doing Yellow Dog, we're working hard to get a new release out pretty much twice a year, I think, was generally our schedule. But meanwhile, I'm thinking about, you know, all this technology is great, and I've loved the being self-taught in Linux and hacking around, but I also kind of had this awareness that I liked the big picture. I liked the part of what we did where we were building a community of customers. I liked the sales and marketing, watching Kai in action with that and contributing as I could. And I wanted to be a little more well-rounded, I guess, versus focusing down the engineering path, even though I really enjoyed technology. And so I went down the road, stayed kind of close, went to University of Colorado at Boulder, and went into their business school. And really had a great time there. It was exactly what I think I needed to do exactly kind of what I set out to do, which was get that other perspective and learn about, you know, the finance and learn about marketing and learn about things. And it's not like you could go to one of these programs and like next thing you know, you're a business genius, but it was just that other perspective that I really had yearned for, having spent so much time as pretty much the only guy for a long time doing a lot of the technical bits with Yellow Dog. I mean, we had some help a little bit, but I was kind of the guy for a number of years. And so that's why I kind of wanted to go that other direction.
You were probably inspired by Kai, because seeing him run the company and do the business and make the money, you probably felt like, well, there's only so much I can do here as a Unix geek with a high school degree. So I can see that.
Yeah, exactly. So that was great. And then after I graduated, which was in 2004, I decided that I wanted to do something different. I wanted to kind of OS X at this time now was starting to get mature. I was really impressed with what Apple was doing as a company at that time. I mean, it was really starting to fire.
We're into the Jaguar days here, 2004. Jaguar and almost Tiger, not quite.
Yeah, and the iPod was on the scene, fledgling, but big potential. So kind of the second coming of Steve, as people talk about, you know, that was when Apple really started to hit a stride as a company that was going to obviously bring a lot of great products after that. So I was really excited about that time for Apple, being that in our Yellow Dog days, we were sometimes working on the one hand and helping Apple sell lots of hardware into these government agencies. On the other hand, we were not exactly, you know, fully embracing Apple's platform, because on these machines, we were replacing the operating system. So I decided I wanted to get a little bit of a closer look at Apple. And so I really wanted to work for Apple after graduating. But therein lies a little bit of the decision point again, where I've got some of these technical skills. I went to school for business. So what do I do? Am I going to go work on some project as an engineer? Well, probably not. There's guys and gals that went to college for engineering and had skills that were well beyond what my self-taught skills were. So that wasn't probably viable. And I liked the idea of starting small and working into something. So I decided, you know what, I'm just going to go work in an Apple retail store, as funny as that sounds. And it was so great. I started as a part-time person, but pretty quickly I started getting promoted and, became full-time, and then ended up being, a manager in the stores. And I just met some awesome people, and I still had that opportunity. You know, Apple is a pretty small flat, or well, it's a lot larger now, but kind of a flat organization. So, you know, my boss had a lot of exposure to the guy, Ron Johnson, that was running retail. And of course, Ron Johnson worked directly for Steve Jobs. And so you kind of got this sense, even though you're working in a store in Colorado, that you're part of something. And so it was really great. Eventually, though, as my boss got promoted, he kind of took me along with him into a corporate position where I didn't have to move to Cupertino. I got to work from home, and I spent about 8 months, I think, before I left, basically supporting stores across four states. And so I got to be kind of an interface point where the store teams, you know, they're selling products every day and they're educating customers. And oftentimes they need to know what the mothership thinks about something, or they need help rolling something out, or, you know, you need that connective tissue back to corporate. And part of my role was to be the person that they could go to. And that was during the time, of course, where the iPhone had just,
connective tissue. I love it.
Yeah. iPhone had just shipped. And so that was a really, you know, really great period of time. But I got to go to Cupertino, I think it was in late 2007, and the group that I was with were in a meeting where one of the marketing executives was sharing that Apple was going to do an app store, right? Because at this point in time, jailbreaking was, even though the phone was only on AT&T and it was still $600 or whatever it was originally, jailbreaking was starting to become kind of a big thing. People
wanted it myself.
Yeah,
I admit it.
Such a hunger, right?
It was
easy to do.
I put a T-Mobile SIM in there, and I was really happy.
Yeah. Well, and part of it was exactly what you said, is getting it on a different carrier. But the other part of it was there was those of us that had downloaded, you know, the kind of crummy apps that were on the Blackberries at the time, and we kind of longed to see modern software running on the iPhone. And jailbreaking was the only way initially that you could write software for the phone. So the idea that Apple was acknowledging, hey, we need to do a SDK and we're going to do an app store, was super exciting. And
apps were really a big thing then. I mean, it was looked like the sky was the limit.
Yeah, and a lot of the first ones were games, and so I kind of knew that there was a big opportunity. I knew I wanted to do something. It was the Apple time was really tremendous, but it was time to kind of go on and do some my own thing. It was going to be around this app ecosystem, but I was never a game designer or a game producer in any way. I didn't have any experience in gaming other than playing them. So the thought of going and building games wasn't something I thought I could go tackle. So I decided to start Double Encore, which was really focused on being one of the first in North America, at least, dedicated development shops that a company could hire if they wanted to go build an iPhone app.
I think that's where we bumped into each other at Macworld, and you had just started Double Encore.
Yeah. And even in the first year of Double Encore, I'm on a lot of phone calls. I'm talking to a lot of people about why they or their company should need a Mac. And there was definitely people that saw the apps were going to be big. There's also a lot of people that really didn't get it, didn't understand why it was important. And it was hard. The first few years were really hard until Apple hit their inflection point with downloads.
So you launched Double Encore with the idea that you would help corporate customers build iOS apps because they couldn't do it themselves. Is that right?
Yeah, they weren't going to, at least for in the early days, they weren't going to have the internal skills. You know, you weren't going to take a Linux programmer working on server software and all, or somebody working on Java, and all of a sudden they're running, you know, writing Objective-C to build these iPhone apps. Maybe eventually people would start to develop those skills, but I just felt like in the early days it was going to be few and far between, and so there was a consulting type opportunity, kind of again back to that Terra Firma where Kai was building websites for clients. It was sort of that kind of company, but for mobile apps.
So you opened an office in downtown Denver.
Yeah. And so
did you have an investor?
Yeah. So that's an excellent question. No, we didn't. And it was, you know, started with just me.
Sometimes that's good.
Started with just me in a coffee shop, no investor. I had worked at Apple at a time where the stock had done really well. So I at least had a little bit of a safety net to take that risk. And so in a way, kind of Apple was the investor just because I had some stock. But it was awfully hard scaling it from one person and then to having to have a team, right? Because the first thing I needed to do was have a customer. Like, what do you do first? Do you hire engineers, or do you?
Or it helps to have a customer so you can make payroll.
Well, exactly. So that was the early dilemma. If we don't have an investor, if I'm, you know, sure I'm not getting paid, but that's what. You know, but I had a little time to figure that out. But it's not like I could take on a payroll liability just right out of the gate in a speculative way. So the first order of business was to just get out there and start talking to people. And the first app that we built was for a tech startup in Denver called Brightkite. And Brightkite was, in a lot of ways, like Foursquare or GoWalla, these kind of check-in based social networks, kind of ahead of its time. I mean, when we were working on Brightkite, I don't think the iPhone shipped with GPS yet. Now, eventually, it got it, and that made the service much more interesting. Push notifications made the service much more interesting. But the first iteration of the app really was missing some key things that later Apple would deliver, and it would make the experience better. So that was the first project, and landing that enabled me to really quickly have to figure out how I was going to, you know, hire a couple people and get a team together. And so we started with a team of, I think, two of us in addition to myself, so three total. I did work a little bit on the project as well, because I figured I needed to understand how hard it was to learn this stuff too, if I was going to be able to make a compelling case to somebody or a company that this skill set isn't just something that their Java developers can deploy and go do.
Were you right in there with the other guys writing Objective-C code?
I sure was. I had to teach myself. And it was really hard. It was the first three months, if Objective-C kind of felt like a foreign language compared to anything in programming I had seen before. It's just stylistically so different. And so it was hard to read and it was hard to learn. But then you kind of get over a hump, and I, you know, I was never the best or whatever, but I at least was the point where I could get certain things done and help out around the edges of the project. I was never implementing key things, but helping kind of around the edges.
Cool. So that's a good lesson. Start small, work hard, build your team. Don't expect too much too fast. But once you get a grip, and once you get famous, well, semi-famous, and you can build on that and develop more clients. How big did you get?
Yeah, so my whole theory was that we had to build a portfolio. It was just a portfolio theory. And the better our portfolio would get, the bigger we would get, be able to get, and the more impact we could make. And so in the end, while we were in the process of selling the company and ultimately selling it, I think we were around 50 people, most of which were in Denver, and which, by the way, you mentioned the office, and we had multiple offices over the years because we always grew out of them. And in the earliest days, when I would be on calls with folks, they would kind of be surprised that we were in Denver. But Denver has totally changed over that time period, and now it's a really there's investment dollars available. There's incubators like TechStars in Boulder, which started in Boulder, and now Galvanize in Denver. And so there's just an ecosystem around entrepreneurship and specifically around tech. So Denver is the best it's ever been now. And I think it's really up there with some of the, you know, obviously not Silicon Valley, but with Portland and Seattle and Austin as being a really great.
Some people are calling it Silicon Valley 2.0. That's maybe a little bold, but I've heard that.
Yeah, well, I don't know if I'd call it that, but it's certainly a really great place. If somebody wants to start a tech-oriented company, I don't think you can beat it. And so it's just been exciting to see that transition, because at the beginning, when I started Double Encore, people kind of thought it was a little weird.
You got really big. You had clients like JetBlue and the PGA Tour and Turner Broadcasting and Major League Soccer, some really interesting clients. Were you able to grow into some office digs where you were able to have like a big wooden table and a big window and invite clients in? Because I always imagined you'd be sitting there at this big, you know, oak table conferring with these executives and a whiteboard, you know, this is how we want our app to look. And here's the design and everything we want you to do.
Yeah. I mean, our first three offices were really not sexy at all. And I did have to bring clients. I had to bring clients to them sometimes versus going to them. But the last office before the current one was starting to have the character. It was a little bit in a rough neighborhood, the ballpark neighborhood in Denver, which has a kind of crazy nightlife. So it wasn't always the best area, but we had kind of an open floor plan and our office had kind of a cool vibe and we were about 20 people then. And so that was the start of kind of having a neat office. And then the current one is
lots of brick and ceiling fans and Macs everywhere.
You got it. Yeah.
I've seen those. Yeah,
but the current office is on 16th Street, and it's just a really cool space we designed kind of from scratch and had it built out for us with the help of the guy that owns the building. And it's just it's the kind of space that you would expect from a company that has gotten to a certain level and working with some really great customers and, you know, really regarded as one of the top companies in the mobile app development space.
Tell me about the fate of Double Encore.
Yeah. So, you know, it was 50, around 50 people and we were doing great. We expanded to developing for iPad, of course, still iOS, but also Android. And then also starting to explore some other platforms. But I'm just speaking for Dan right now because I had other folks that were, you know, involved in helping me run the company at later. Originally it was just me, but later we had a team. And so I kind of had come to the conclusion that as more and more traditional companies were going to build, were either going to build the competency in-house to build apps, or that your traditional agencies, digital agencies building web pages and so on, were going to develop the skill set. And the issue that I saw was that while we were doing great work for some great customers, me and one other guy were predominantly the business development people. So, and even if we were on a plane every single day, there was only so many potential customers that we could be in front of. And so I kind of felt like what was going to start happening was either we would need to dramatically change how we were selling and build a business development organization and a sales effort. Because I saw that as the agencies were going to start winning more and more business because they were building this capability, or at least said they had this capability. There was a lot of subcontracting that would and probably still does go on in this space where, you know, big company sells the deal, but then they sub it out to a smaller firm like a Double Encore. And I never wanted to do that kind of work because we could never put it on our portfolio. And we would always be just that subcontracting team and never be able to really thrive and grow on our own merit. So I really shied away from that sub work. But I really felt like we needed to be at more tables, trying to be in front of more companies, because others were going to be building this capability. We were early, and certainly there's advantage to being early in a space, but there's also no disadvantage to a company coming in that's much larger and has, you know, large sales force and so on, coming into the space. There's no disadvantage to that. So I kind of had come to the conclusion that I didn't know that I had the skills to build a sales organization that would be effective. I'd never done that before. So I started thinking about how can we complement what we build at Double Encore, a great technical team, a great design team, and attach it to something that has the business development side that we need and can open the lead funnel and pipeline. And that's just a short synopsis of a little bit of my thinking at the time. But where we landed was that an agency called Possible, based in Seattle, they are owned by WPP, which is one of the largest advertising holding companies in the world, wanted to start doing more and more in mobility. And they had a lot of great customers too. But whenever it came to building mobile apps, they didn't necessarily have an answer as part of their story. So, but they were in front of a lot of big brands. And so that was the marriage that took place. And so now Double Encore has become a company called Possible Mobile. And it's still in the same office, but now it's got 32 people, I think they said the other day, in Atlanta, Georgia, people in Seattle, people. And so it's really scaled. And that was the whole thing, was I wasn't sure that we could scale it like that, doing it on our own.
Is this about the time you met Joe Pasillo?
Well, I'd met Joe about a year into Double Encore, actually. Mm-hmm. And Joe was involved in the iPhone dev camp community, kind of did a number of things around organizing that early iOS community. So that's how I met him. And we started, you know, getting to know each other and talked about, in a gold rush, maybe the thing to do isn't to build isn't to mine for gold or dig for gold or try to build a hit app, right? Maybe the thing to do is to build the picks and the shovels. And
I remember you telling me that, Macworld. That was so cool.
That was our whole thesis for what's the picks and shovels play in the iPhone development. You know, that Double Encore had one role as a consultancy, and that was all great. But that didn't mean that I didn't still also see that there was an opportunity to do something that other agencies could use, or the indie developer could use, or the big companies that are commissioning these app projects could use as kind of platforms to help them. And so Joe and I, in 2009, so that was only a year after I started Double Encore, Joe and I decided to start Push.io. And Push.io was a push notification service provider, one of the first of those, because to send push notifications, especially at scale, to some of these apps now have millions and millions of users. If you want to send something out to all your users, like breaking news or something, you actually need a decent amount first of all, you need software in the cloud to do that, but you also need a decent amount of hardware. So we built that. And so for a while there, I was kind of splitting time between landing new projects with Double Encore and selling apps. And then on the other hand, realizing that this pick and shovel opportunity with Joe around push notifications was really applicable to just about every app developer.
I'm seeing two themes here. One is your vast server and Linux experience, and two, staying ahead of the curve and seeing what's next.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Well, we're almost out of time. We only have a few minutes left. Let's kind of finish up with what's happened most recently, and then we're going to have to kind of phase it out here.
Well, sounds good. Most recently I spent the past 2 years at Oracle. Push.io became part of a group in Oracle called the Oracle Marketing Cloud. So I just spent 2 years integrating our push system into the Oracle Marketing Cloud, and also helping to set some direction around how should Oracle, specifically the Marketing Cloud, be thinking about giving marketers the ability to go after the mobile audience, whether it's through apps or the mobile web and other things. And so I spent some time doing that and feel really good about what we accomplished and decided that there's just so much now. I mean, when I first started Double Encore in 2008, the iPhone thing was just getting started, but we knew it was going to be big. And it just feels like now we're at about another one of those sea changes in the industry with AI and machine learning.
Oh, yeah.
And
maybe the end of the app era, maybe in the next era, as you said, AI.
Yep. Chatbots and mm-hmm. autonomous cars and drones. And it just feels like we're on the precipice of another really fundamental shift. So, you know, I'm taking a look at some of those areas and
I can't wait to see what you're going to do next. It's going to be cool.
I'm not going to announce anything here, but yeah, I'm excited about doing a new company that tackles one of these areas.
What a cool career. What a fascinating story. Thanks for sharing that with me.
Absolutely.
So, folks, we're going to have to wrap it up here. One more item. Dan Burkott, tell the listeners how to contact you if they wish.
Well, I would say the easiest way is I'm on Twitter. I'm not a super prolific tweeter, I guess would be that way I'd put it. But I do use Twitter, and my handle's at Burkaw, B-U-R-C-A-W. And I just love following people like Elon Musk and others. And so that's a great place to connect with me.
Cool. Well, thanks for being on the show. Again, fascinating story, inspiration for everyone. Folks, I hope you enjoyed listening to Dan and me chat. And we'll see you next time on the Mac Observer's Background Mode.